When I returned to college after Christmas break my freshman year, I told very few people that my 23-year-old Irish twin brother had committed suicide on Christmas Eve. It wasn't because I felt shame or guilt. In truth, I don't know what I felt. I just hated the awkwardness that follows when someone finds out about such tragedy. Most stammer about how sorry they are, all the while wishing they never asked and looking for any opportunity to get away. Even more, I just didn't want to hear people tell me, as they're prone to do at the small Baptist college I attended, that they were praying for me and my family in the hope that God would make everything right again. Inside, I would scream, "It'll never be right again, no matter how much you pray." You can't say that to them, of course, because they mean well, and they wouldn't understand that the God about whom they spoke and to whom they prayed, a God who intervenes in history, who takes away pain and suffering, no longer made sense to me, was no longer a God I could believe in. One friend, thinking she was doing me a favor, gave me a copy of the poem Footprints. "Read it," she suggested. "I know it'll provide some comfort to you, like it did for me when my grandmother died." So I read it. But instead of feeling better, I got pissed off. The poem's about a person walking on the beach with God, who asks where God was when a tragedy happened in his life. God's reply was that once the tragedy struck him, there was only one set of footprints in the sand because God was carrying him during the tough times. "Are you fucking kidding me?" I asked. "I'm sure losing your grandmother was painful, but can you honestly stand there and tell me that the pain that my family experienced, that my mother felt deep in her heart when she heard about the police prying my brother's hands off the steering wheel after he shot himself in the face, could have been worse? Trust me, we looked for God, but God was nowhere to be found. The gut-wrenching sobs my mother cried that day tells me that she, not God, bore the full brunt of the pain that comes when she lost her son." I tore the poem up, threw it on the floor, and walked away. It was halfway through the semester in my required religion class that the fog surrounding my brother's death began to lift. We were talking about the crucifixion and how in the moments before his death, Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The class was small, only 22 students. Most were religion majors. It was the largest major on campus. I wasn't surprised to hear many of them echo the belief they'd heard in their churches that this was all a part of God's plan for the salvation of the world, that Jesus didn't feel forsaken. He only said it for the sake of those around him. My professor looked to see how I was reacting to the discussion. Because of several conversations I had with him outside of class, he knew the struggles I was having, the questions I was raising. He listened patiently to the class before he spoke, but it was clear to me that he was as uncomfortable with the direction the discussion was taking as I was. With tears forming in his eyes, he asked how anyone could believe that a loving God could demand such torture, such suffering. In words that continued to echo in my mind 30 years later, he said, "Don't you see? The horror Jesus anticipated in the Garden of Gethsemane was now a reality. He prayed that God would take the cup from him, but God didn't. He prayed again, but there was no reply. And now the time had come for him to drink. But where was God? He had lost that sense of presence. He felt alone. He experienced abuse and ridicule throughout his life, but God's presence was real. But now, in his hour of need, he was hurting and alone and needed the reassurance of God that everything would turn out all right. But God was absent. He cried out, 'I gave you my all, God. I sacrificed everything. I've been faithful, and you've been with me. My God, why now do you forsake me?'" The darkness that engulfed the land overwhelmed him. There were no signs of hope. God did not respond. He felt alone, utterly forsaken by the God to whom he had committed his life. And in this darkness he died. I believe, as George Harkness wrote, this was his hell. Not merely to suffer, but to suffer and seek in vain for God's sustaining presence. Many students in the class looked quizzically at one another, their eyes revealing their own discomfort, wondering what was happening. But no one said anything. "Where's God when you need God?" he continued as he looked directly at me, echoing the question my mother and I had asked on that fateful Christmas Eve. In times of suffering, I'm not sure one can ever adequately answer this question. But I do know that simply saying to those who suffer and who feel abandoned by God, God is with you, you just don't know it, or God will get you through this if you just believe and have faith, doesn't do justice to the sense of abandonment and forsakenness people who suffer experience. We shouldn't trivialize those legitimate moments of unbelief or unfaith that suffering, especially innocent suffering, often bring. One student worriedly asked, "But we've always believed that God loves us, especially in those moments. Are you saying we're wrong?" Realizing her concerns were genuine, and sensing that others shared her sentiment, he replied, "Not at all. I'm just suggesting that God's love is not demonstrated by protecting us from the pain and tragedy of life, but in helping us create new possibilities out of such tragedy. Illness, accidents, death are misfortunes that make no distinctions. They happen to all of us at one time or another. Senselessly, perhaps, but they still happen. The good news of the cross and the resurrection of Jesus is not that God protects us from harm's way, but that God suffers with us and will work with us to create new possibilities, even out of the most meaningless situations." With that, he wiped his eyes and dismissed class. Out in the hall, students were talking about what our professor had said. Some were angered by it. "Who does he think he is, telling us that our beliefs are wrong?" Others were confused, not simply by the words, but by the emotion he'd expressed. They'd never seen a professor cry before. Was he teaching or was he preaching? I responded with tears of my own, not because his words made me sad, but because he was the first to speak directly to my experience, to what I was feeling and thinking. The tragedy of my brother's death was senseless. We never found out why he did it. We could only surmise. But his suicide brought my family together, really together, for the first time in years. Bobby's death confronted us with the reality of how much we were strangers to one another and how little we knew about each other's lives. His death rekindled our sense of what it meant to be a family and the love we felt for one another, a love that continues to this day. This was the meaning we were creating together. Was God a part of that? I didn't know, but it made more sense about God's role in our lives than anything else. I was moved most, however, by my professor's passion. He cared deeply for the ideas he taught, and even more for the students whose lives he touched. He wasn't afraid to challenge us, to push us to move outside the narrow confines of our own perspectives to see the bigger picture, and to force us to embrace the ambiguity so much a part of life. But he did it in ways that invited connection and community with him, with each other, and with the broader world of ideas and people. We spoke frequently about these things for the rest of the semester, and he often provided readings, like C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed and Abraham Heschel's Essays on Divine Pathos, that helped me to make sense of it all. It was then that I knew what I wanted to do with my life, the path I wanted to follow, to teach, to express the same passion for the ideas, for the people who generate them, and for the students who encounter them, who bring their own stories and experiences to the table, often born of confusion and tragedy. I changed my major from sociology to a double major in religion and psychology. I went to seminary and earned a Master of Divinity with a focus on pastoral care and counseling, a course of study I felt would provide a foundation, not simply for teaching, but more importantly providing the understanding, care, and sympathy future students might need. I was able to practice and develop these skills in my years as a hospital chaplain and a community organizer in poor, struggling neighborhoods. My first teaching jobs while completing my Ph.D. in religion and ethics were in county, state, and federal prisons. In many ways, they were some of the best students I had ever encountered. They had a thirst for knowledge, although often without the preparation most college students bring. And they certainly had their stories. Stories of physical and emotional abuse, extreme poverty, and tremendous loss, not only of loved ones, but of their personal freedom. Eventually, I came to Lemoyne, where for over 20 years I've sought to engage students in my required courses to understand the importance of studying the religious and ethical complexities of our increasingly global, religiously pluralistic world, to develop a stronger sense of themselves as moral agents, and to take an active role in and responsibility for their learning. At the same time, following in the footsteps of my professor, I've worked tirelessly to create a classroom environment where their own perspectives and voices could be articulated and heard, while offering a listening ear and a gentle, sympathetic presence whenever they related their own stories of confusion, loss, or tragedy. The beginning of each fall semester and the advent of Christmas will always remind me of my brother and all those who suffer some affliction, self-imposed or imposed by society, many of whom continue to sit in my classes year after year. Like the father whose 9-year-old daughter died of leukemia, the young man who buried his mother after a long, unsuccessful battle with cancer, and the countless young women who continue to struggle with the emotional pain and psychological scars of being raped by male classmates they thought loved them. I hope I'll continue to feel the same empathy for them as my professor did for me, offer to be present with them and to provide some comfort, and, when the time is right, help them to find meaning even in the midst of the senseless, the tragic, and the ambiguous. Meaning that often arises only in the context of renewed relationships with family, friends, and faith. For as much as anything else, this is an essential part of my vocation, my calling as a teacher and a person.